Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of the Year of Plenty podcast. So before we get started today, I just want to share why I haven't really been uploading any episodes in the last couple of weeks. As some of you might know, I was on a trip in Germany. It was a great time. I do this every year. Some of you might know that I'm originally from Germany and, you know, moved to the US about a decade ago. But yeah, I had an amazing time, did a lot, got to visit a farm, actually two farms. I did a lot of cooking, a lot of outdoor cooking. Also got to go visit the Alps for 5 days, which I haven't really done before. So we went on a great 5-day hiking trip through the mountains. Even though it was, you know, really grueling at times, I just felt amazing afterwards and all the experience I got to make and all the great scenery I got to see. If you ever have a chance to go, you have to do it. And then I got back a couple days ago and immediately had surgery, so that even, you know, delayed the podcast schedule even more. But we're back now, and today's episode is a conversation I actually recorded in Germany with my stepbrother. I've been trying to get him on the podcast for a while now, because, you know, he's one of those people with whom I started this journey of trying to learn as much as possible about real food and fight this, you know, growing disconnect from our food systems. His name is Max Kühnhöfel, and as you will hear in a second, he's a super knowledgeable and genuine guy. Now, Max currently works at a biodynamic farm in Germany, and, you know, you'll hear in the podcast what that's all about. He's also a hunter and fisherman, so he has a great appreciation and understanding of the natural processes that allow us to bring real, recognizable foods to our tables. It really took me a while to convince him to come on the podcast because he was kind of worried about his English skills. But I think in the end he realized that we're all going to forgive him for his accent. Personally, I think he did an amazing job for barely ever speaking English or using it in his daily life. So just to give you a little quick overview of this episode, we start out talking about hunting in Germany. Then we go a little bit into the farming apprenticeship Max did after high school. And finally, we talk about the meaning of biodynamic farming and the biodynamic farm that Max currently works at. So I hope you guys really enjoyed this episode. I surely had a great time recording it. All right, let's get into the episode with Max. I'm currently in Germany right now, as some of you might know by following my Instagram. And I'm sitting here right now outside on our back porch with my stepbrother, Max Kühnhöfel. And I've been wanting to get him onto the show for a while now because, you know, he's very into food, just like me. He's a foodie as well. So he is German, and he might have a little bit of an accent, but I know you can all forgive him for that. So, yeah, how you doing?
Hello, everybody. I am very pleased to be in your show, Pulley, and let's talk about food. What do you think?
That's what I'm talking about. So we're currently actually, you know, why don't we start with this? We're eating a classic food from the region that I'm from in Germany right now. And that is literally sausage in a can.
You told me that in the US you don't have this kind of sausage.
We don't have sausage in a can. And I think most people listening right now probably associate it with Spam. It's not that at all. It's pretty much literally... You know, when you make sausage, you almost make a meat batter, like when you make a cake. And that is the filling, which you fill into, usually it's intestines from sheep or pork, or in artificial intestines. And that's what is your sausage at the end. So instead of filling this meat batter into the intestine or into the artificial intestine, they put it in a can and then I think they boil it, right?
They boil it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can also put only meat in a can.
Put the microphone a little closer.
Okay.
Yeah, right there.
You can also took some meat and put it in a can.
Like
you use a little bit of salt, and so it's called salt meat.
Salted meat, yeah.
And salted meat.
And yeah. it's not even the sausage at that point, you know. It's just meat.
Just meat with salt, yeah.
I know they do that in the U.S. I have friends whose, you know, grandparents, they take venison, deer, and that's one way they use it. They make, salted meat out of it in a can. And supposedly it's very tasty. But what we're eating right now is pretty much just a bratwurst in a pan, in a can.
Bratwurst.
Yeah.
Is it called like that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it's called. Brats. And in Wisconsin, where I'm from, you know, everyone knows what a brat is. Brat, that's like the most Wisconsin food ever. Because there are so many German people there. Right? And yeah, while we're doing this, we're about to light a nice cigar, which, you know, we like to enjoy every once in a while. And you might hear it in the background, but we have a fire going, and we're actually cooking up some food in a Dutch oven, in a cast iron Dutch oven. We're doing some layered meat. And if you listen to the last episode of the podcast, I talked a little bit about layered meat and what it is. So we're doing it again here in Germany now, but this time instead of beef, we have venison, roe deer, actually. You like roe deer, right?
It's my favorite kind of meat, roe deer. I think it's so tasty and soft, and I think the animal eats only the best things available out in the nature, and it's delicious. I think everybody should try this kind of meat. And
that's for sure. I mean, in the US you can't really get roe deer. It's a species of deer that we, as far as I know, don't have.
Okay.
But you know, any kind of deer is super tasty.
I think all kind of deer taste
special.
Special, yeah. And I think the roe deer is the finest of all. In that doesn't mean that it's the
tastiest,
but maybe it's the softest and the finest of all.
Yeah, like the most tender.
Yeah.
And well, like you said, roe deer eat very special, you know, herbs and grasses. It's not like a cow or an elk. They're not just out there grazing whatever is in front of them. They selectively pick certain foods.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's what makes them, you know, superior in many ways.
If you sit outside and on a field, and if you watch them come out of the forest, they eat one leaf, for example, and then they step another 10 meters or something like that, and then they eat another piece of leaf or flower or something like
that. Or grass. Yeah, it's very, very selective. That's kind of cool. So roe deer are way tinier than, you know, what we're used to in the U.S. Like white-tailed deer are probably double the size of roe deer, if not even larger. And elk is way, way bigger. But yeah, it's the main kind of deer species here in Germany, or at least in the region that we're from. We're in the very south right now, and we actually went out to hunt some today. We went on a little spot and stalk mission, or I shouldn't call it a mission, but a spot and stalk hunt, and we haven't done that in a while, and it was really cool. Right now is the rut for the roe deer. What that means is they're making babies, to put it in simple terms, which means that, you know, they might even be very active during the day. Usually, you know, deer or any kind of wildlife will, you know, be most active in the mornings or closer to night. Is when you will see them. But during the rut, which happens right now in the summer, you know, they're active all day long pretty much. So what we did is we went outside. Max took his rifle, and I just decided to be his cameraman and spotter, I guess. And I have a call to literally, you know, attract the male, the buck, the male deer. And I wish I had it with me right now. Maybe I'll get it in a sec. It pretty much makes two different calls, which resemble female calls. And the calls are meant to attract the bucks, you know. So we pretty much walked through the forest for 4 hours, very quietly, of course, very softly. We spooked the deer right away, right? That was weird.
Too bad.
Yeah, we went into literally walked into the forest, and there was a deer. And you know, when a deer doesn't know that you're coming and you scare it, they're gonna make a lot of noise. They start screaming.
It's like barking.
Yeah, it's literally like barking, like a dog barking.
Yeah. If you don't know it, you could think that there's a dog.
Yeah, and this deer did not shut up. It just kept going and going. So we thought, oh, well, we, you know, maybe our day of hunting is ruined. But, you know, we kept going and didn't see anything for the first 2 hours, right? But after that, you know, we had a little luck. We were able to sit down on a close to a fox den, actually. And, you know, the forests here in Germany are beautiful. It's all carnivorous forests with a little to no undergrowth, but there's a ton of moss. So it looks like a fable forest, kind of like a, almost like straight from a fairy tale. And, you know, we sat behind two big trees, and then I called. I used to call to hopefully attract a buck. And you want to tell what happened?
We waited about 5 minutes, and then on the left-hand side, we behind a little tree, and there were some bushes, and we thought that we had seen something, and there was a roebuck, yeah.
Yeah, so I saw him coming in from the left, and you know, kind of made a hand sign to Max, trying to show him that there's a buck coming. As soon as I saw him, though, he was already gone in the thicket, in the bushes. But then I called him again, and then you saw him again, right?
Yes, we were hoping that he would come in front of us, out of the bushes, so that we can get him with a good shoot. But it did not happen.
And that's part of hunting, you know. It's a lot of people, you know, see hunters in a bad light, I think. They think we just go out there and as soon as we see something, we shoot. But that's not the case at all. You know, there are people out there that do that kind of stuff. But, you know, especially in Germany, we get taught the ethics of hunting. And part of the ethics is, you know, you only pull the trigger when you're 100% sure that it's going to be a good shot. Mm-hmm. So
I think I'm a hunter now for 3.5 years, and I went out hunting, I think, more than 60 or 70 times, and I only shot 5 animals till now.
So, as you guys can tell, you know, there's a lot to it, and, you know, if you can't make the shot, you just don't. And if something doesn't feel right, you don't make the shot either, because you don't want this animal to suffer.
And the other thing is with the roe deer, I think it's the smallest species of deer all over the world. And they weigh about 20 kilograms.
20 kilos, yeah. Is the weight of them, usually. That's the average, I'd say.
And if you put out the intestines and everything, you don't have more than 14 or 15 kilograms here in this area and in South Germany.
Yeah, so that's the bones without the guts. Without the intestine, all that, just the bones and the meat and the head, of course. It's about 14 kilograms. So, you know, how much meat do you think that is at the end? Maybe like...
I think it's...
10? Not even.
Not even. I think 7 or 8
kilograms. 7 or 8 kilograms you get from a good average roe deer buck. That's why we're doing it. We want to have quality protein, quality fat.
Exactly.
For the kitchen.
The good meat, and we want to pay the animal some respect. And I think it's important that the animal doesn't suffer if you kill it, and also that you have not too much damage on the meat.
Yeah, that's right.
Both of them things are important.
All right, so we had a little problem. We were sitting outside, like I said, and as we were talking, you know, a big rain cloud pulled over us, and it started to rain. And we kind of took that opportunity to take a little break real quick and check on the fire and on our Dutch oven, on the layered meat that's cooking in there for the next probably 2.5 hours. It's looking good so far. We had to add a little bit more wood. What do you think? Do you think it looked pretty good?
I think it looked pretty good, and it smells. The beer, we put some beer in it.
Yeah, so we put some beer into the layered meat for, you know, added liquid so it wouldn't dry out.
I think the beer brings in some very good taste.
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, we also took the chance to pour ourselves a little scotch, a little whiskey. So both of us are very much into whiskey. That all started probably like 9 years ago.
I think so. Nine or 10 years ago.
Maybe we'll get into that after we finish our little talking on the hunt we did today. So yeah, like I said, we were out there doing a spot and stalk hunt, and what we used, because it's the rut, is a little call called the Butolo in German. Not sure what it's called in English. I think that's actually the brand name. And it does two different female roe deer calls. So let me just show you, just so you get an idea of what we're doing out there to try to attract one of these roe deer bucks. So this is the first call that they'll do to attract, or it's pretty much a call that tells, you know, the roe deer buck, hey, I'm willing to mate. Check this out. So it's just a very high-pitched kind of squeal. You do it three or four times, you know, and then you wait and see what happens. And then as you progress, the second call is pretty much what the female roe deer does if it gets chased by a male buck. And that kind of sounds like this. So I hope you could hear that pretty well. Thought it might be interesting.
Maybe you can add that if you use this tool outside and you want the call to be very natural, so it is important that you took the Butolo to the left side and then to the right side, and you can turn around while you're doing this.
Yeah, so anytime you're calling, you know, you're pretending to be an animal, right?
Yeah.
And the animal is not just going to stand there and just call into one direction. It's probably going to be moving while it's doing it. So you're literally out there moving around, you know, left, right, doing the call, trying to imitate a real female roe deer. So yeah, that's a very good point. And, you know, someone who doesn't hunt, probably, you know, if they would see us in the woods, it would look funny. But, you know, we're usually by ourselves out there. Thank God.
So, Puldi, is it also your first time that you used this?
Yeah. So
last week?
Exactly. So this year is the first time we're actively trying to hunt the rut of the roe deer here in Germany. And I'm here every, you know, summer to visit family and friends. But it's the first time we're doing it with this call. And toward the end of the hunt, the last hour or so, like I said, we were in this part that looked like a magical forest, like a straight out of a fairy tale, with a bunch of moss and beautiful pine trees and fir and spruce.
Blueberries
on the ground.
Also blackberries.
Blackberries too. So yeah, it was great. And we positioned ourselves behind these two big trees and were able to call in a nice roe deer buck. But like Max said earlier, it just wouldn't sit there and it wouldn't give us, you know, its perfect sight. So no good shot we would not have been able to make a good shot.
Okay, I want to add something to the hunt. If you do like a, what's it called? A
spot and stalk.
Spot and stalk hunt, yeah.
And we can explain that quickly. You know, spot and stalking, like I said earlier, is you're actively on the ground trying to find the deer or whatever you're hunting, and you're moving throughout the forest or throughout the plain, wherever you are. Whereas an ambush hunt is, you know, you're sitting in a tree stand and you're waiting for the deer to come to you.
And I think 90% of the hunting in Germany is with a tree stand.
Yep.
A static hunt. So it's special to do a
Spartan stalk.
Spartan stalk, yeah. And I wanted to add, it's very important that you be careful of the wind conditions and the weather conditions. When we started it, after 10 minutes, it started to rain. And that was great because the forest absorbs the noise that we make. And so you have more chance to get close to the roe deer.
Yeah, so exactly. And all the rain, you know, makes a lot of noise. So if you're stepping on a little twig, it's not going to be loud. Because usually if it's not raining, like I dare all of you to try, you know, walk through the forest quietly and get close to a deer. If it's a deer that's not used to humans, it's going to be very hard. Especially, you know, as soon as you step on a little twig, you know, all eyes are on you pretty much. So it's, yeah, that's a big part. So I figured, you know, a part of this podcast, you know, is kind of explaining to people or getting people to realize that there's a lot behind bringing quality food to the table. Yeah. Be it farming, or be it hunting or fishing or any of those activities, pretty much. And hunting is a big one for us because, you know, you and me, we've always kind of been involved in it. But, you know, we did our hunting license in Germany and our hunting course about 3 years ago, I'd say now.
3.5 years ago, yeah. We finished on May 2016, I think.
Yeah, and in Germany, it's a huge deal because, you know, not a lot of people do it. They make it very hard for you to hunt here. And you have to go through a rigorous course. So we actually took a... First of all, you have to be 18 to do it, I'm pretty sure, right?
Yeah, if you want to hunt on your own after the course, you have to be
at least 18. And then it's about, you know, it's over $2,000 to get in. So it costs a lot of money. But besides that, you know, it's a time investment. The course we did was about 9 months, I would say.
9 months, yeah.
Yeah, and
every weekend we were there.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So we had to buy, I think, about 10 books for this course. So it's literally like a college class, you know, for 9 months. It's like a semester of college, but what you're learning is, you know, everything about the forest, everything about the animals here in Germany. You're learning about the rules, the actual law that's associated with hunting. Then you're learning about all the different weapons, the guns, you know. What else did we learn about? There's a ton of stuff we had to do.
Also, a big thing are the dogs, the hunting dogs.
Huge, yeah. So in Germany, there's a lot of hunting with dogs. These are very highly trained dogs that actually have to go through a 3-year program, I think, right? Yeah. To get certified to be able to be used when hunting. So these dogs are, you know, they're trained to aid the hunter, pretty much. There's a lot of different breeds, and pretty much all the dogs we know kind of come from these German dog breeds, right? Hunting dog breeds. What's your favorite hunting dog?
It's called the Deutschstrata.
So in
German
English...
German wire-hair.
Wired-haired pointer.
Translate it directly, yeah.
That's what it's called, German wired-haired pointer.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Nice, and this is my favorite dog because the dog doesn't have the short hair, and I think it's robust.
It's much more robust, yeah. You can take him out in the winter. You don't have to worry about him freezing.
Yes.
If he gets wet and all that, yeah.
You can take him right through the blackberries.
Yeah, they will go right through the thorns.
He doesn't mind.
They won't mind it, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a pretty hardcore dog. But yeah, back to the hunting course. What else did we do? I mean, we had to literally go through the forest and learn every tree around us.
Yeah, every bush, every tree, almost every plant that we saw. It was very interesting. We had an educated forest man.
Yeah, a forester.
He started forestry. Also, another big part of the hunting course was hygiene.
Hygiene, yeah. So animal hygiene and hygiene in the kitchen when you're butchering, right?
And also for your own safety, that you have a close look to the intestines and to the meat of the animal.
Inspecting the meat.
Inspecting the meat, that was a big thing.
Yeah, so we actually had a veterinarian, a lady who, you know, actually brought in intestines from pork or from pigs and
from
cows,
slaughterhouses,
and she would have us look at them and say what's wrong. So, you know, some might have a disease, some just might have a weird look to them. And in Germany, that's a big part. You as the hunter are responsible to make sure that the meat you're getting is safe, because contrary to the US, here in Germany, you can actually sell meat. You can sell wild game meat. And that's something we can't do in the U.S., mostly because of a history of, you know, market hunting that really decimated and destroyed a lot of wildlife and was very anti-conservation of wildlife. But in Germany, because of the traditions and ethics surrounding hunting here, they have figured it out and they allow market hunting for certain animals. And a big part of that, of course, is, you know, you got to make sure that the meat you bringing to the market is good, is healthy. So that was a big part of this course that we did. A lot of shooting, of course. We had to shoot at 100 meter deer targets. We had to shoot at an aluminum, or I think it was a steel target of a wild boar that would, you know, it would start on one side of the range and then it would move to the other side, probably like 10, 20 meters, right?
Yeah.
That was hard. That was extremely hard.
Yeah, at the beginning it was very difficult, but we trained that every Friday afternoon.
Yeah, so we
trained it.
It was us
over half a year.
Yeah, it was us training to shoot at a moving target pretty much. And you know, that's something I wish they would do in the US. As far as I know, the hunting education there kind of lacks the whole, you know, the whole shooting part. I mean, they do shoot at targets and they do shoot at clay pigeons and all that, but something like a wild boar or just a moving target in general, I don't think that's very emphasized. And you know, if you want to be a good hunter, that's something you have to learn. Now, it got to be honest, though, if you don't keep practicing it, you know, you lose it.
Yeah.
I stopped practicing when I moved back to the US, and I'm still very, very careful. I wouldn't really necessarily shoot at a moving deer or a boar, unless, you know.
Yeah.
I still have a lot of respect of that shot, that kind of shot. I'd much rather wait for it to stand still so I can, you know, actually aim for where I want it to hit. Because when you're shooting a moving deer or a moving animal, you have to aim farther ahead. So you have to lead it on. And, you know, that makes it extremely hard. So there's some hunters that, you know, they practice this all the time. They're just amazing at it. They can shoot at moving wild boars, running wild boars, and hit him, shoot him perfectly every time. And that's something that's got to be practiced and something we got to do more, I think, still. Yeah. Even though we learned it and we, you know, did good during our exam, because here in Germany, after this 9-month hunting course, we had to take a written exam and we had to do several practical exams, which one was, you know, shooting at the moving boar. And we had to, I think, we had 5 shots, right? But we had to, or 3 shots, I think it was.
I think 5 shots, and you have to
hit it 3 times.
Yeah.
In the right spot, yeah.
In the right spot.
It was a small area that we had to hit. I mean, much larger than for the deer, but still pretty small.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was difficult, but you know, that's made us into the hunters we are today.
Yeah, and you also have to add the rabbit. To shoot on a moving rabbit.
Yeah, so in Germany we actually have a big jackrabbits. Jackrabbits, they're much, much bigger than the little bunnies we have in the U.S., the gray rabbits there, the little hares. But yeah, usually they get hunted. And they taste amazing. I mean, wow. I haven't had one in a while, but I would love to shoot another one to, you know, prepare it.
I only tried once the meat of that kind of rabbit, but I think it's as good as the roe deer.
Really?
Maybe it tastes better.
Better? Why do you say that?
Because the rabbit is a special animal. It eats a lot of herbs, and the way it lives, it's very special, and
it's niche. Yeah, it's very specialized again, similar to the roe deer.
Yeah,
yeah, and these jackrabbits can get pretty big here, but sadly, over the last 10 years or so, you know, their population has really decimated. It's really gone down, mostly due to, you know, bad farming practices. And you know, overpopulation of predators, I would say. But as far as you were telling me, they have now kind of recuperated. They're doing better.
Yeah, during the last 2 weeks, we see more of them. This year, I think I see one of them every second day.
Yeah, and that's huge.
Yeah, and I think 2 years ago it was they were not in that population. It was not that big, the population.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. That it's sad, you know, to see certain animals go. And people think that we hunters are often responsible for that. But that's really the contrary. A lot of hunters are the reason why we have certain animals and why there's healthy populations of them, especially in the U.S. There's a lot of misinformation on it. And, you know, the way the U.S. system works, it treats the animals as a renewable resource. The system makes sure that there's enough for the years to come and that there is a sustainable population. Same here in Germany, I would say.
Yeah.
Here it's more the hunters doing it. Over in the U.S., it's more the law telling you how to do it. Here there's a lot of ethics involved, which was another class we had, right?
It was an extra class.
So here
the traditions and...
The traditions and ethics of hunting were literally an extra class that we had.
Yeah. I think this was also very important to hear something from the tribals and the tradition, and that you have to have respect and treat the animals in a good way.
Yeah, for sure. That's huge. Because, you know, if you're out there, you're taking another being's life, right? And if you don't treat it with respect, chances are, you know, we're going to get what we had 200 years ago when hunters literally, you know, in the U.S. especially, took out thousands of bison, thousands of other animals, you know, just for the fur, for example, or just for the meat, and, you know, almost drove certain animals to extinction. And that's something we don't want. We're literally hunting for the fun of it, of course, but also, you know, mostly for conservation and for getting meat, because we love to cook, right? And, you know, that's the message I guess I'm trying to get across to people, is that not all hunters are horrible, and that not all hunters, you know, just want to kill. There's a lot of us out there that have huge respect and for the animals and, you know, a lot of ethics that go into it. And, you know, I would much rather eat an animal that I, you know, shot myself, that I killed myself, that was living in its natural habitat its whole life, probably had a great life. Not an easy life, because nature doesn't make life easy, but, you know, had the life it's supposed to have. And I'd much rather have that than some, you know, factory farmed pork or chicken that was stuffed in a cage with thousands of others and industrially processed and whatnot. Which, well, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think you can't compare the wild animals with the meat from our
factory farms.
Factory farms, yeah. And I think also the organic farms, which work in a very natural way of raising the animals. I think you can also don't compare this to the wild animals, because the wild animals, they are outside every day, the whole year. They have to suffer in the summer with the heat. They have to freeze in the winter. They have to take care of themselves. And that goes right into the quality of the meat.
Yeah. I mean, it has to, you know. If an animal is living the way it's supposed to live, eating what it's supposed to eat, you know, it's going to be a different type of meat.
And also an interesting thing is that if an animal is ill or something like that, it searches for a special plant, sometimes even toxic plants, that may help the animal come out of its disease. And I think if you have the animal on a farm or something like that, and it only can eat what you are giving to the animals, they don't really have the chance to feel into themselves and to go after their instincts.
Make their own choices.
Make their own choices, and yeah.
Yeah, that's huge. So you actually, you know, decided to become a farmer about, I'd say, 3 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little bit. So you decided to go into organic farming. And why did you make that decision?
Well, it started when I went to school. I always thought about working in the agriculture. I went to a Rudolf Steiner school. And in the ninth grade, we had to participate 4 weeks on a farm, on an organic farm, to take a look at the work the farmers have to do the whole year. And it was a really important time for me. And later on, when I absolved the school,
when you finished school?
When I finished school, yes. I thought about studying biology because I thought that if I study biology, I have to do with the plants and the animals, and I can go outside. And I started studying biology, but after the first 3 months, I couldn't see myself becoming a biologist. I thought I have to wait a few years till I can go outside and
engage with the natural world.
And yeah, exactly. And the main thing was, if you read books about agriculture, or if you inform yourself about agriculture, it doesn't take much time till you see that the agriculture is really in disease. It's ill. The same system, how can I say, it is not very sustainable.
Yeah, the way mainstream or conventional agriculture is being done right now,
yeah,
is not a long-term solution for the health of, you know, our soil, for the health of our planet in general, and surely not for the animals and the people eating that food.
Actually, it's really easy. If you have a healthy soil, you have healthy plants growing on this soil. And if the animals eat that plants, they can also become very healthy. And if you eat then the animals, it's healthy for you.
Well, yeah, there's a saying I really like, and I've talked about this in other episodes, and it's by Michael Pollan, who is a big writer on organic agriculture and just the agriculture systems out there right now. And he said, he likes to say, you are what you eat, ate. And yeah. I think that's a good way to put it, you know.
Yeah.
So you started your first year on my godmother's organic farm.
Yeah.
In Hohenroden, that's what it's called. And how many acres do they have? Or in Germany, they have hectares, right? It's yeah. It's a big farm. How many fields would you say?
They had about 120 acres.
Acres, okay.
Yeah, and they had cows, horses, pigs, forest, a lot of forest.
So they're also hunting there, and they're, you know,
they are hunting,
processing the meat and selling the meat.
Yeah. And they also want to have their trees raise up very good so that they can sell the wood.
The wood and the fruit, of course.
And the fruit, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a very special time to me because they gave me the chance to come into hunting, to come into the agriculture, see a lot of things. I don't want to miss this time.
Yeah.
It was the start. Yeah. And until that time, I will not say that I was a lazy guy, but I always thought on one day you can't work a lot. The day is too short. But when I started doing that apprenticeship in the agriculture, I started to see again how long the day could be. And if you always try to give your best and help each other, you can solve many problems and you can work a lot on one day.
You know, organic agriculture still utilizes a lot of people, right? It takes a lot of people because you're not using giant machines mostly, and you're not using a lot of, you know, chemicals. So there are certain jobs that will require more people. Do you think that's a downside for organic agriculture, or is that something that's good?
I think that's very good, because I think it's important that more people are into the agriculture, and it's in the people's mind what it means, the agriculture. I think 100 or 150 years ago, more than half of the population worked in the agriculture.
In the agriculture industry, yeah. I heard about that too. A lot of people were farmers or gardeners.
Our ancestors, they were farmers in the last few centuries.
Thousands of years.
Thousands of years,
agriculture started about 8,000 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's pretty much what, you know, formed our societal systems that we have today. People settling down and starting farming.
Yeah, and to me it was very important that the knowledge of how you farm sustainable, I think you have to pass on that knowledge from one generation into the other. And I thought that I have to go into the agriculture and try to learn something from that knowledge. Even if I would another job after the apprenticeship, I thought it is important that, I think it's the wrong word if I sacrifice myself to get the knowledge, it sounds not good.
You could say, you know, you sacrifice time, right? You sacrifice 2 years of your younger life to learn this knowledge, but sacrifice does sound a little, you know.
Yeah, it sounds too negative.
Too negative. You're right.
Yeah, and that's
invest. How about invest?
Invest. Yeah,
that's a better word for it.
Yeah,
you took time, you know, to learn these old skills that people have used for thousands of years. Because essentially, that's what organic agriculture is, right? A lot of it is still using methods that people have utilized for a long time.
Exactly, yes. And to me, it was important that this knowledge has a future. And in Germany, a lot of farms are closing. More and more people step out of the agriculture, go into the industry or something like that. And I thought that it's necessary to have people going into the agriculture, learn something about the knowledge, the methods you have to use, and not only that, but also you have to develop the agriculture.
Make it better with time. That's a good point. Great point. So what would you say to someone, you know, a young person that has always played with the idea of becoming, you know, a farmer, especially, an organic farmer obviously, but just, you know, isn't sure if it's the right move? What would you say to them?
I would say that if the person really thinks about doing an apprenticeship or something like that, or
just working on a
farm for 1 or 2 years, that time is used really good.
It's very valuable, yeah.
Valuable, yes, because you learn a lot about the natural circles. You are outside for a whole year, and you really connect with the nature and the weather conditions, and you get a strong
understanding,
yeah, of how our life even today is independent of what's going on outside.
So I see what you're saying. So I always say too that, you know, we humans have kind of built this artificial infrastructure for ourselves that disconnects us from the natural world. Yeah. And that's one thing, that's what I realized through engaging with food. It's one of the reasons why I started this podcast, you know, hunting, helping you on your farm, cooking, you know, really engaging with the raw ingredients, the real food, kind of showed me that, you know, we're part of this natural earth, we're part of these natural cycles. And even though we have this artificial infrastructure that we've built for ourselves, we do need to engage with the natural world every now and then, you know, to really understand it, to gain appreciation for it, and to make, you know, to make good decisions for the future of society and our planet in general.
Exactly. I think sometimes I have the feeling that some people are afraid of engaging with the nature. I think some people think that we have to fight against nature. But today we know so much about the natural circles, and I think we have to use them for us.
And work together with them. Yeah.
Work together with
be
them.
Be part of them, yeah.
Be part of them. And that's the reason why I wanted to learn something about the organic agriculture, because in this way of farming, you want to work with the nature, yeah.
Yeah, you want to work with nature instead of against it, what a lot of conventional farms are doing.
Yeah.
Right? Even here in Germany, they see nature as the problem, right? All the things that nature throws at them, the pests, the diseases. But if you're really trying to work with them, build a healthy soil, for example, or, you know, plant certain plants that have a variety of plants, not just a monoculture, you know, you're kind of mimicking these natural cycles, it can work out, you know. You can work with nature in a positive way, still have your harvest, and, you know, make agriculture sustainable and also, you know, profitable, right?
Yeah, and you get the best quality out of your food.
That's a huge point.
If you plant the trees in a variety, the whole system is healthier.
Instead of just having one single tree, yeah, or one single plant.
Yeah, because you get an ecosystem.
Yeah, that's very true. So, you know, you have, you know, obviously went into organic farming, but then about halfway through your apprenticeship, your three-year apprenticeship, you decided to take it to the next level, right? You wanted to see another farm, you know, learn more about agriculture and organic agriculture. And then you decided to go to a biodynamic farm. Now, I've talked about biodynamic on one other episode, I think. Not a lot of people know what it is. Let's talk about biodynamics a little bit and how it works, what it really means. So as far as I know, from what you've told me, it's the oldest standing organic farming there is out there, right? It utilizes very special methods that have been around for a very long time. Who invented it, do you know?
It was founded in the 1920s or 1930s. And the second big brand of organic farming in Germany is called Bioland. I think it was founded 1980.
Okay, so
there are 60 years between
both of them.
Both of them.
So biodynamics, you know, you called it a brand, but it's more like a label. It's more like
an
association that, you know, tells the farmers what they have to do to be able to be certified biodynamic. Same with the other organic one, Bioland, which you were just talking about, that came way later. You know, we can compare this to kind of the different types of organic labels that we have in the U.S. Like, we have USDA certified organic, and then there might be another organic label that is done by a third party association. And the biodynamics is not only the oldest, but it's also the strictest organic label or organic certification you can get.
Yeah.
Right.
In Germany, it's we've got the organic label. You have to have it because of a law. And then there are Bioland and Demeter, it's called, the biodynamic label. They say that the normal organic law is not strict enough, and they want to farm with stricter conditions. They want that their farm is more transparent. And the heart of biodynamic farming is that the farm is it's like an organism. That means that every part of the farm, the whole variety, the cows, the soil, everything is like a body or an organism with different organs. And you have to take care of the whole organism. If you only pay attention to the money you earn, you wouldn't do some kind of things. But if you take care of the whole organism and you want that it stays healthy, you have to take care of these special things.
Yeah, no, so that totally makes sense. Instead of, you know, just following the money, you're making sure that every aspect of the farm, every little, you know, animal you have, every cycle is in tune and is working well and working right. So that includes, you know, feeding the right food, giving the animals the space they need, right? All that kind of stuff. So what made you want to go toward the biodynamics specifically?
I read a book from a biodynamic farmer.
You remember what it's called?
Yeah,
what he's called, his name?
It is called, in Germany, it's called, the book is called Der Weg aus der Krise, The Way Out of the Crisis. And it's written by an old biodynamic farmer.
What's his name? What's the author's name?
Karl Ernst Osthaus. He's an old
biodynamic
farmer, and he described the way you have to, you want to farm on a biodynamic farm, yeah? And he described everything. He described what is needed to have a healthy soil, and that you have to take care of the forests, that you have to plant trees and bushes into the fields, that you connect with the insects and the birds. It is really the whole thing that you want to interact with in your farming system. And it's the opposite of specializing your farm onto one thing.
Like just corn, or just cows.
And that makes it so interesting, because if you have cows and you have a soil and you have bees and a forest, and maybe you're a hunter or fisherman, if you have all of this and you know something about all of these things, you can see that it's all together. It is not good if you specialize yourself only on one or two things, because it could be that you don't see the whole system and the effects that you have on the other ecosystems and things like that.
On some of the players in this whole system. So yeah. Like, for example, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, if farmers or conventional farmers are using a ton of fertilizer, right? The rain might take the fertilizer into the stream that's close by because of all the runoff, all the rainwater. That stream will take the fertilizer to some lake. And now at this lake, there's an overload of nitrogen or whatever fertilizer they're using. And then plants explode, algae explode. So, you know, the amount of light that's going into this lake might change, which is going to throw off the whole ecosystem in this lake. So that's like an unwanted effect that you, by understanding the whole system and with biodynamics, you know, trying to balance this whole system, you're going to avoid these fatal mistakes or unwanted side effects that might happen down the road, right?
Yeah. And the second big part of biodynamics is that you try to produce everything on your own. The food for the animals, the fertilizer. You try to get out everything out of your own farm.
That's
so
you
that
don't,
it's an own circle.
Yeah, so you don't have to buy much from anywhere else. So
yeah.
You're very, very sustainable in that case.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Awesome.
And that you have a look at the quality.
You are in control of the quality, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You never know if you're buying it, you know, what you're getting or where you're getting it from. But if you're doing it yourself, if you're making your own, you know, food, for if you're growing your own pastures for your cows, or you're growing your own, what do you usually feed your cows?
Grass.
So grass, they're mostly fed grass, right? And or hay.
Hay,
grass. You produce your own
hay. Yeah.
You produce, you know, your own herbs, whatnot. You guys even make your own like tinctures and your own fertilizers, right?
When it comes to fertilizers, we have the poop and the compost. Yeah, we bring it back to the field and try to feed the soil and not the plants. That is an important thing. We want to feed the soil. Yeah, the bacteria, the insects that live in the soil,
microorganisms, yeah, microbes. Yeah.
We want to feed them. And then if we plant or seed something on into the field, the roots can go into the soil and they have to get the nutritions without our help. Yeah,
yeah, it's got to get it from the soil.
From the soil.
Whereas other farms will just go out there and spray chemical fertilizers, yeah. Right? That's interesting.
And we think, or we are convinced that this kind of farming brings out a different food with a different quality. It's different if you have a plant that has to use its own roots to get water and to get the nutrition. Sometimes the roots have to go
very deep,
to get to this nutrition and water. And we think it's different comparing it to feeding the plants right on the soil. And if you feed the plants too often or too much, we think that the plants look really good. They look satisfied and they look like they've got a lot of
potential. Yeah.
But if you take a look deep inside the plant, and if you think about another thing, if the plant really lives outside and has to take care of itself, it has to work.
Nutrients.
Yeah, that's the right word. The plant has to work to survive. Yeah, and I think that gives the plant a different quality. And after that, after the harvest, you feed it to your animals or you eat it on your own. And I think this quality comes right into you.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting ideas. And, you know, I wish more people would think that deeply about their food, you know, because I always say, you know, most people don't look past the supermarket shelves. And they don't think about what they're putting into their bodies. But it's awesome that there's people out there like you that are really trying to, you know, produce quality food and really second guessing or questioning the mainstream, you know, and the way people or most people are doing it. So that's awesome. And so let's talk about the farm you're at a little bit right now. They're mostly a dairy, right? It's a dairy operation.
Yeah, it's a dairy farm. Yeah.
So you have how many cows?
We've got 45 cows right now.
And they're mostly outside all day, right?
They can decide if they want to go outside or if they want to stay in the stable.
So they have access to pastures right outside.
Yeah.
With big doors. I've been there.
Yeah.
And if they want to go outside, they can go outside whenever they do, or whenever they choose to do so. Yeah. And then you milk them. And the milk, so you sell the milk fresh, right? Even you have a vending machine.
Yeah.
The people from the surrounding towns can come to and get fresh raw milk.
Yeah, they can get it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Yeah, the whole week.
It's a great idea. I don't know why more people don't have a vending machine like that, you know.
Yeah, they can get the raw milk. It's not even boiled.
Nothing, yeah.
Nothing. It is. We milk it. We milk twice a day, early in the morning and then in the evening. And the milk is only pumped one time from the milking stand into the tank. Then we cool it down to 4 degrees Celsius.
Just to keep it safe.
To keep it safe, yeah.
So that's like refrigerated, pretty much.
Yeah, You have to cool it down very quickly, yeah.
Yeah, awesome. And then you guys also have a cheesery. You make your own cheese on at the farm. High quality cheese. What's your favorite? You hated cheese forever. I mean, it was so hard to get you to eat, try cheese. You never did. But now you like it, right?
That's right. And this was also a reason why I wanted to take a look at a dairy farm, because in Europe and especially in the south of Germany, we are very near to the Alps, and in the Alps the people needed animals which they could milk, because it's very difficult to plant corn or something like that in the Alps, because the soil is not very good. It's a very thin soil. It's not that deep, so that the plants could...
they just don't grow there very well.
Yeah, exactly. The weather is very harsh and
so they focused very rough. They focused mostly on animals.
On animals, yeah, exactly. They use their axes to cut down the trees, and so... they had some grassland, and they used cows or sheep or goats
to maintain,
and they started
it,
to milk them. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they had meat and milk. That was a simple thing. Yeah. They had the milk, and the problem with milk is that if you don't cool it down, you cannot eat or drink it anymore if it gets too warm, or if you... leave it just for 3 or 5 days, it gets sour and
it gets bacteria form in there that you don't want to ingest,
and you have to throw it away. And the people thought about what can we do with the milk
to keep it fresh
and
good for consumption.
And so they started making cheese. I hated cheese, and I hated the smell of cheese, to be honest. But later on, I thought about, I live here in Europe, and dairy is a big thing in Europe, and especially in South Germany near the Alps. And I thought that if I work in the agriculture, and if I do an apprenticeship once in my life, I have to visit a dairy farm, I thought, because it's such a big thing here in Germany and in Europe, and a lot of people eat products right out of the dairy farm and everything.
And that's a great point. I really like how, again, you think about, you know, why is cheese even made? Why do we make cheese? Well, people in the Alps decided to make cheese to keep, you know, the milk fresh, because that's the only thing they really had. They couldn't grow a bunch of plants to sustain themselves. And the cheesery you have at your farm is awesome. And then you guys sell the cheese at you have your own little store where you don't only sell your cheese, you also sell bread that you make at the farm.
Yeah.
You also sell your vegetables that you grow, the meat from some of your cows, right?
Yeah.
So that's awesome. And it's working, right? You have a lot of customers, right? They come to the farm.
Yeah, right now it's very good. We've got a lot of customers, and I think that the customers they are looking for something like this. They really enjoy coming to the farm and take a look into the stable, into the field. They want to see the animals. A lot of customers don't want to, they want to convince themselves right at the farm.
They want to know if what they're getting is quality. Is it really what you guys say it is? And I think it's awesome that you guys provide that service. You let people come to the farm. They literally, it's open whenever you're working. People can come, they can walk into the stables, they can pet the cows, literally.
Yeah.
They can go out, look at the fields. And I wish more places had that, because people, I hope and I really think people are now looking for that kind of experience when it comes to food. More and more people, at least. Not everyone, of course. A lot of people don't even give it a second thought. But at least for those who do care and for those who are interested, you guys provide that opportunity. And I encourage anyone, you know, listening to, if you have an organic farm and you're curious, you know, you want to see what it's like, or maybe you're thinking about buying some of the food they produce, just ask them if you can go take a look, you know, and build a relationship with that farmer, or, you know, the farm in general and the people that work there.
And if it comes to visit a farm, or if you want to work, even if you want to work for one day, it's not really complicated. The farmers are not very complicated.
Well, they would gladly have you come work for them.
Yeah,
you
know, exactly.
Even if it's a day. I think anytime I've come to your farm, everyone is super nice. It's a great community, and you know, it seems like people are very excited that other people are coming and wanting to engage, and you want to share that experience with anyone, pretty much.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the reason why we also you can visit the farm even with large groups of people. Yeah, we can put you right into the stable and tell you something about the farm, how it works, and show you the different rooms. And we think it's really important that the customers, yeah, that they can see into the farm.
Yeah, and just see how you produce the food. So what do you say to anyone, or to someone who doesn't really buy organic food, or doesn't even think that there's a big difference between food that, you know, that's made on conventional farms or that's not organic and not biodynamic, for example?
That's difficult. And I think it's not the most important thing that it's from an organic farm or if it's biodynamic. There are a lot of farmers outside which they do a great job. They don't use any label to sell their products, and the quality is extraordinary. It's very good. I think the most important thing is that it's not important if you have a label or if it's organic. I think most important is that you go to the farm and convince yourself on your own if the farming process fits into your believing.
Your belief system. Yeah.
Yeah. And I said that it's not the most important thing if you buy organic products, but the good thing, and you can be safe that the farmers don't use the chemicals and the chemical fertilizers
and pesticides,
and that's a big thing. But if you really want to see how they behave with their animals and how they treat their animals and if they have respect, I think you have to go right onto the farm, have a close look, and if you think that's the way you want the farming to be, you can support the farm, buying your food from this farm, get into the farm, maybe you can help there sometimes, or you can ask the people the things you want to know about the farm. And I think that's a different way of, you can connect with your nutrition and your food, and the food becomes it's got a soul. And if you only go to the grocery store and the supermarket, you don't really know what stands behind the product.
Yeah, it's true. You're missing something, an important link, I think.
Yeah.
And really trying to understand your food and going to the farm, or growing it yourself even, going hunting, going fishing, you know. For me at least, it gave me a total different outlook on food and nutrition and what it means to eat healthy, and, you know, even the whole cycles of nature and the health of our planet, you know. So, well said. I that was a good answer there. So, you know, I think it's time for us to check on our layered meat Dutch oven. We've kind of neglected that. It started to rain, so hopefully the fire isn't out. But what's the farm called you're at right now? Maybe we can share that. And if anyone is, you know, in Germany and wants to look at a biodynamic farm, I think yours is, the one you're working at, is a great one to go to.
Yeah, it's called Sonnenhof, Sun Farm, if you translate it into to English. And if you want to visit the farm or an organic farm, you have to just go to the farm and ask the people whatever you like. And
it's literally it. You just go there. So it's in a city called Bad Boll, right?
Yes. It's
for those of you looking
town,
for it.
It's a little, yeah. It's in,
so maybe just Google Sonnenhof Bad Boll and, you know, pick up a sheet of paper, write down the address and go visit, you know. And your name is, again, Max Kühnhöfel, and maybe you're still working there then, and if someone wants to visit, you know, go look for him. I'm sure he'd be glad to give you a nice tour, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for doing this, man. Thanks for sharing your knowledge and your beliefs on all of this. That's all I have for you guys today. If you find this podcast valuable, please consider supporting it. You can review and rate it on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app that you use. Reviewing the podcast is still one of the best ways to really support it because that allows us to reach a lot more foodies like you and I. And of course, you can also share it on social media with your family and friends. Or even better, tell someone about it. You know, tell someone who you might think will also get value from it. Word of mouth is still my favorite way to get the word out. In the show notes, I've included a share link that allows you to share the podcast super easily with anyone. Otherwise, you guys can visit my website at www.theyearofplenty.com. There you will find a subscribe page with which, you know, you can directly subscribe to the show so that you will never miss an episode. If you use social media, you can follow me on Instagram. My name is Poldy Wieland, all one word. The podcast is also on Twitter and Facebook. Just type @TheYearOfPlenty into the search bar. Otherwise, the show notes will have all the links. Thank you so much for listening and all of your support. I really, really appreciate all of you foodies who take the time out of your day to listen. So let's keep learning and exploring real food and drink together.